that's what's so fundamental about it being a spectrum. Because again, you can have different flavors of neurodiversities, you know, swapping and changing. You might have a diagnosis of dyslexia, but that doesn't mean there's going to be aspects of, you know, ADHD that you might be experiencing. It's not a zero-sum game. So I think if, you know, if your young person that you're working with or that, you know, is in your household and they think this is, you know, what is going on, they're doing that, then actually the best thing you can do is listen.
It's me. Hi. I'm the problem. It's me. The lyrics of pop icon Taylor Swift's song Antihero are so popular, they've been turned into a funny meme. But what if you are a girl that really believes she is the problem? She's convinced she is the problem as she thinks, experiences, and functions in the world differently than others. And she knows that this is because she is neurodiverse, and she simply doesn't fit in the world. The challenge for the adults who love her: ensuring that she knows how to turn her neurodiversity into her superpower. Easier said than done, as the saying goes. Neurodiversity manifests differently in girls, so may not be diagnosed as quickly as it is in boys. And research tells us that girls who are neurodiverse are even more at risk to suffer mental health issues. In fact, often the neurodiversity in girls masquerades as a mental health issue, complicating the diagnostic process further. The journey for girls with neurodiversity is not only hard for her, it's equally hard for the adults who love her and know her to be wonderful just as she is. This episode of the podcast is for them, but the girls in their lives might enjoy a listen as well. Before jumping into our conversation, let's hear from some girls on what they have to say about our topic today.
Especially being a neurodiverse girl, I think because it's less recognizable in girls often, it feels like when I'm asking for help, I'm making myself bigger than I need to be, almost. Like, I'm making something that isn't there. So I find it useful when teachers, like, initiate the conversations or, like, will talk to me separately about it.
When we went in geography, every week, like, most weeks in our double, we do something interactive. And we're still, like, learning. So, like, last week we were playing different rocks, acting out them. But you remember it now because you remember the thing. And we, like, went to the Bromley High Beach. There's, like, rocks along the thing, and then people act, like, rocks in the corridor, and people acting like wind and waves. And it's what makes you remember.
Because you remembered that lesson now, didn't you?
I do, yeah. And it was weeks ago.
One of my favourite things about my ADHD is my creativity. I have really, like, high levels of empathy compared to a lot of people.
I won't.
And I'll get really emotional so much.
I won't stop until they've told me it's absolutely fine.
I'm Trudy Hall, your host for The Connected Girl, a podcast series produced by the International Coalition of Girls' Schools and part of the On Educating Girls series. Today, we're in conversation with Emily Rushton, whose mission in life is to celebrate the inclusion for neurodiverse students and students with disabilities. She knows this world from the inside out, as she is neurodiverse herself. Yet through study, research, and practice, she has become the go-to source on neurodiversity in girls for the Girls' Day School Trust, a family of 25 exceptional girls' schools in the United Kingdom. A teacher in primary and secondary education and a doctoral researcher at the University of Cambridge, she couples the practical with the theoretical to ensure that strategies to include neurodiverse students are both grounded in recent research and can be applied in real life. In short, she knows her stuff and she walks the talk. Emily, this is such a critical topic, and I'm so pleased that you're the one who's going to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much. It's exciting.
I think we should start by letting our listeners know that your interest and your passion about this is very, very personal. What got you started in this realm of education?
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes quite difficult to extrapolate because for me, it really is. It's a passion. It's what I've wanted to dedicate my career to doing, but it did come from a very personal place. So when I was sort of going through this education system as a disabled young person, however many years ago, I had an experience that I then became very determined that I didn't want to recreate. And obviously, we're very, very lucky that we're now educating in a very different time, and neurodiversity and the research around it moves at absolute head speed. We are learning more all the time and advocacy is getting better. Championing is all getting better, but it's had to get better from a place. I really almost quite vividly remember, you know, when I kind of walked out of those school gates at 18 and I was going to university, and I really did feel like at times I was really kind of being kept together by the STEM department at my school. And my teacher, who again, I owe everything to, you know, she kind of really did do everything in her power to help me. It did sometimes feel like she was kind of siloed in that. And it did feel that, like, you know, we got through those things, but by the skin of our teeth. And then I felt very empowered. And I was very lucky to be very empowered when I went through to university, because I know what I needed, because I had someone fighting for me. And I know that, again, my situation, my experience was really challenging, and that was with that person. So I always think about all the students that didn't have that person fighting for them, which is really then I kind of made that decision of, right, I will be that person. And I didn't necessarily expect it to go this sort of stratospheric, because then I thought, oh, you know, I'd quite like to have my hand in some send. And instead I've just, my entire career has become send. But it's really the best thing that could have happened, because every single day is different. Every day is exciting. And, you know, the best bit about it is the amazing neurodiverse people I get to work with. So I don't think I could do anything else now, actually. I don't know what I'd do in a slower job. I don't know how I'd act.
Well, you just introduced us to a great word, send. And so since this is an international podcast, can you start with send, which is a term that you use in the United Kingdom? And then could you introduce us to some other neurodiverse terms that will work across the cultures as we have this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously I'm coming from a UK context, and SEND in the UK, that's what our Department of Education uses. And SEND stands for Special Educational Needs and Disabilities. But I know that obviously in different countries, under different systems, different terminologies are used. So that's why we tend to sort of talk about, if we're talking specifically about different learning conditions, so things like dyslexia, autism, ADHD, they all very much come under the spectrum of neurodiversity. And that's a term that I think, depending on what country you're in, it's a term that's quite consistent. And when we talk about neurodiversity, that's what we're thinking about. We're thinking about those conditions, those neurodevelopmental conditions, and also those sometimes acquired conditions as well. That means that all of our brains work in this beautiful different way. And even though, you know, historically sort of neurotypical brains have been the ones upon which we've kind of structured how we've done things in society, we're really starting to recognize that actually the beauty of the world comes from actually how everyone thinks differently. And actually championing those neurodiverse voices is really the key to pushing it forward. And, you know, I'll always go back to, I'm a bit of a kind of a geek in that way in terms of the research, but Judy Singer, who is one of the first researchers to ever talk about that, she talks about how fundamental neurodiversity is. And, you know, when people compare it to sort of biodiversity and how fundamental it is for us to all be able to thrive as a society, it's a really positive and person-centered term to use. And also to recognize that actually these things are on a spectrum. And you might have different flavors of it, but ultimately there are things that all of us can learn and adapt to ensure that we're making everybody feel included.
I like your comparison of biodiversity and neurodiversity. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously, we appreciate biodiversity. Why shouldn't we? And why wouldn't we appreciate neurodiversity? And I know you're really focused on girls and neurodiversity in your work. Let's dive into that. Why is this a compelling arena for you in your practice?
So I'm really coming from this as somebody who not only works in a girls' school, but also works for a whole trust. So a whole group of schools, which are for girls and champion girls' education. And the really interesting thing about neurodiversity in girls is that you almost have this kind of intersection of marginalized communities. So you almost have girls who, again, in society are often fighting for their space in places. And yes, things are getting better, but there's still so much more to do on that. We're still not in that equal ground. And then when you cut that down even further to girls who are neurodiverse, you end up with this even smaller group. So when we're actually looking at the reality of it, it's when you have, it's almost like a marginalized group of people. So actually it's even more important that we're really advocating, championing, promoting inclusion and understanding in this area. Because also that there are lots of reasons why neurodiverse girls might find things in a neurotypical world more difficult to access because there are lots of things, especially teenage girls, you know, if you take sort of middle school age girls, for example, you know, when they're constantly just wanting to blend in and that they're wanting to sort of build that community. So what can be trickier is that if you're already trying to ascertain lots of different communication styles and lots of different social cues, and again, if your brain is working in this absolutely beautiful way where you're thinking about all of these things all at the same time, for girls, what they then have a real tendency to do is put on a bit of a mask. So actually it really affects when and how we know their neurodiversity is manifesting and presenting, if that makes sense.
It does. It makes a lot of sense. And I think as you and I were preparing for this conversation, one of the things you told me was that girls may tend to be diagnosed later than boys, which seems to be another issue that we ought to talk about.
Yeah, and it's because a lot of the time that these symptoms really manifest differently in girls. So when you look at diagnostic criteria for different things, a lot of them, when they were originally put together, were tested on boys. ADHD is a really good example of a neurodiversity that looks so differently in girls to how it does in boys. But because the criteria all those years ago looked more predominantly at the manifestation in boys, it doesn't necessarily mean that girls will meet that same criteria. So it therefore means that they're being diagnosed a lot later when they're able to advocate for themselves and look at those nuances in how it is for them. And, you know, it's also just acknowledging that I'm really someone that, in terms of the concept of gender, obviously is such a spectrum in itself. And that's what makes this so fascinating, is you almost have a spectrum on top of a spectrum. So actually it's looking at, we used to do things in quite a binary way. And actually now we need to move forward with how we are looking at neurodiversity in the same way that we look at gender, you know, that everyone is on a different place in that spectrum. And it doesn't matter where you sit in that spectrum, we need to correlate how that looks for you, how that affects you as a person, and therefore, what are the management strategies and what are the things that you require to be able to thrive. Doesn't matter which version, what flavor of you that you are, you deserve to have what you deserve to have. And that's why with girls, it's really important, because we need to make sure that we are catering to that demonstration of neurodiversity.
So thank you for the use of the word spectrum, because I think that's a word that's also out there in the universe when we talk about neurodiversity, that even allows us to understand more the uniqueness of neurodiversity, that we all are on a spectrum. And if I'm the parent then of a daughter, I'm taking away from what you're saying that I need to be perhaps paying attention to something different in a girl. What kinds of things might I be looking for, paying attention to, observing?
Absolutely. And again, it's really fascinating because everybody is different. And I think even though we're specifically talking about girls, this should apply to anyone, because what you see in one person will be very different to what you see in another. But in terms of girls, I mean, one of the key things in girls that what we see probably more prevalently is this idea we could sort of call rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And what that looks like is it's a real propensity to, and a struggle, I think, almost on a daily basis with worrying about being rejected. So that might manifest as your daughter being sort of particularly sensitive in certain areas. And sometimes that can come across in ways that maybe seem counterintuitive. So that might come across as a bit combative. So that might come across as if you're trying to have a conversation with your daughter and they're immediately trying to do things to derail the conversation, if it's something they're anxious about. It might be because actually that's coming from a place of real worry and anxiety that they're going to be rejected in that situation. So if they've done something wrong, is that going to be a rejection? And therefore, what self-management strategies can I put in place to avoid that rejection? I know I can derail the conversation. And it's just being really aware as well with any type of sort of anxiety, any mental health condition. You know, all the research shows us how comorbid mental health conditions are with neurodiversity and vice versa. It's almost like, let's not just stop there. So even if we acknowledge that your daughter might be struggling with her mental health at that time, is there anything else that might be contributing to it? You might notice that your daughter might be someone who masks in their day-to-day life. So you might have feedback from teachers, for example, that they act one way in school. So, you know, that they follow all of the rules. They're the perfect student. They work super hard. And then at home, it sort of quote unquote feels like the wheels can come off. And then when you try to talk to teachers, they'll say, oh, no, at school, they're perfect, quote unquote. I hate the word perfect. Sorry, I know this is a tangent. I just can't stand it.
As women, we all hate that word.
Yeah, yes. I cannot stand it. I think you cannot say that about a human. My background is Latin, and the word that comes from in Latin couldn't be further from what that word actually means. That's my neurodiverse brain going off on a tangent. But it's these little things to look out for that, you know, there are things that maybe historically we might have kind of brushed under the carpet or said, oh, that's just a teenage girl. But actually it's saying, what is that boundary? You know, actually really thinking about how can we empower our young women and actually say, no, do you know what? I don't think you're just having a hard 6 months. You know, is this something that you're trying to manage? Where do you feel safe to unmask? So we can discuss those things. So it's just about being really nuanced and really aware that there are just lots of things that perhaps up until this point, we might not have considered being a symptom of neurodiversity, but actually exploring that it might be. Because obviously, especially as well, where we are in the media and things, there's a lot of negative news around the rise in ADHD diagnoses, for example, or the rise in diagnoses sort of where people are learning things from social media. It can be really powerful, but it can also be one of those things where if in the media it's perpetuated as being fobbed off too much, then actually, again, we're disempowering even further. It's about that line. It's about talking to people. It's about saying, right, if you've seen this on TikTok and you feel that's what you're seeing in yourself, let's explore it rather than just closing down that conversation.
You've given us another good visual, which is unmasking. You know, where do you feel safe to unmask? And the notion that a girl does put on a mask, take off a mask, which is something that in life we do, but it might be more pronounced for those who are neurodiverse. Let's go to your internet for a moment. We know that our students are probably out there and they're Googling and finding all these symptoms and they may be self-diagnosing. So how does a parent manage that if they are self-diagnosing? I'm sure there are pluses and minuses to that.
Again, the internet is a many powerful thing, isn't it? And you know, as someone who loves a bit of Dr. Google herself, sometimes that can really go into a place that's not helpful. But I always try to think, I mean, I try to see the world in as positive a way as we possibly can. But the most brilliant thing about advocates on social media coming forward and talking about how their neurodiversity manifests, it just continues to open this dialogue about how it is different for everybody. And that's what's so fundamental about it being a spectrum. Because again, you can have different flavors of neurodiversities, you know, swapping and changing. You might have a diagnosis of dyslexia, but that doesn't mean there's going to be aspects of ADHD that you might be experiencing. It's not a zero-sum game. So if your young person that you're working with or that, you know, is in your household and they think this is, you know, what is going on, they're doing that, then actually the best thing you can do is listen. Because again, it might be, as you say, as a teenager, it's really tiring being a teenager. Hormonally, everything is going on, especially for girls. And there are definitely aspects of being a teenager, right? That exhaustion and that difficulty to focus. But people know themselves and you know yourself where the line is. You know yourself the difference between, like as adults, we know the difference between when am I finding things difficult and then when am I actually burnt out? So the best thing we can do for our young people, if they're sort of using internet and social media and saying, right, I'm seeing those aspects of things in myself, just listen, you know, explore, pay attention. Don't try and sort of quote unquote fix it. Neurodiversity doesn't need fixing. It's just your brain. It's just your state of existing. There is nothing to fix. It is wonderful the way it is. What might be even more wonderful, though, is if you had some really useful management strategies for the things that maybe you find a bit challenging. So just sit here, listen, acknowledge, pay attention to it. Because the likelihood is as well is that they've been feeling this way for a really long time and not actually had the articulation to share it. So if your first port of call is to shut it down and say, oh, you've just seen that on TikTok, in terms of the masking as well, that's going to build up a mask even more for someone. The more they feel that this version of myself isn't one that the world wants to see or the one wants to acknowledge. So therefore, I will create this mask. I will be that person that people want. I will be that person that isn't thinking in these ways. That for me is the most heartbreaking thing, is that when you have neurodiverse girls who just mask so much that then actually they lose all the brilliance and the beauty that their neurodiversity gave to them. And it's just exhausting going through the world not being the person that you are. So the more we hear, the more we listen, the more we pay attention, we're going to have these amazing, wonderful neurodiverse women going through harnessing it and giving the world all of that brilliance and all of that wonder that it comes with, rather than it coming with a huge emotional labor and almost this almost quite a lot of like guilt about it, that you're like, oh, okay, I feel like I'm inconveniencing the world by being how I am. And actually it could not be further from that. So we just need to show everybody that that is the truth.
I'm going to make the gracious assumption, because I really do believe this is true, that the parents who are listening today are wonderful parents and they are doing some deep listening. Let's just go to this belief system that they are doing deep listening and they're meeting their daughters and helping their daughters feel safe about taking the mask down. Are there other strategies now that I've listened, now that I've understood? Are there things I might do differently as a parent or actions I might take as a parent?
Absolutely. And again, I think it all goes back to the listening. Once you start with that, if you're there, as you said, then that's a brilliant first place to start. And then from there, it's really about moving forward. Because with all of this, obviously, I speak from a UK context, but I know in the UK, sometimes trying to get a diagnosis, well, sometimes it's always difficult to get a diagnosis with different waiting lists and waiting times. Even if you have these really productive conversations at home and your young person says, you know what, I think this is what I'm experiencing, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to go straight away and have somebody be able to write that down for you. And actually, it's not always the most important thing, because it's about feeling empowered. So actually, if you sit down with your young person and you say, actually, yeah, that this may be how your brain is working, and that's brilliant. So what can we do to help you manage it? Because it might often be that there are some things that a young person is finding more difficult, and that might be the reason that they're looking for further diagnosis. And obviously, it's really important and really helpful when you have a diagnosis. The recommendations are really personalized. It's really fantastic to help you as a person move forward and know what things are going to help you, what things, you know, in those times where perhaps aspects of your neurodiversity might be rubbing up against the neurotypical world, that's really helpful. But in lieu of you sort of being able to access that straight away, it is about thinking about what things in your environment might need to be navigated differently because of this. So actually, are there any things that you can immediately do, even within your home, that might make things easier? So if your young person is experiencing sensory overload, for example, what things can you do at home to mitigate that? If they are struggling with their organization, how can you work together to put different things in place to remove that cognitive load a little bit and really support that executive function? So it's trying to go with it. And I know it's so funny, any of us that work with young people, but your propensity is always to, I want to fix this problem. So if someone comes to you and says, oh, I'm really, really struggling with this aspect of organization, the first port of call will then be to go, right, well, brilliant. Tonight, we're going to go to the shops. We're going to buy all these folders. We're going to label them all. We're going to organize them all. And that's wonderful. That's absolutely amazing. But sometimes that evening, it's probably just best to start with, yeah, do you know what? We're going to look at what we can do. Because even if you have all the folders in the world, and you know, I joke with parents about this all the time, you could have the best stationery in the whole universe, but you're still going to forget stuff. And that's absolutely fine. So it's more just remembering that neurodiversity, it's always going to be perpetually something to work with. It's not something that we can go, oh, we're struggling with organization, let's fix it. It's always going to be something that changes, that works with a person, that adapts. You know, it's living, it's not static, it's really dynamic. So it's always just as well, I think, thinking about going beyond that conversation. So that first conversation might be the starting point, but actually the work, the exciting bit, the great bit comes in what happens after that conversation.
That's a terrific reminder that this is not static. And it's probably the very reason why you're focused so much on empowering a young woman to use her voice, because as she knows herself, she's better able to advocate for herself, even as she's changing. That used to be true last year. Now my issue is this. And so if you're already in that listening mode, then you're prepared for her to change her preferences or grow through a challenge. And as you work with girls over a period of time, do you see changes like that where they are more able to speak up and articulate and talk about what it feels like, what it looks like? If so, what does that trajectory look like? How will a parent know when, okay, she's got this, she's really feeling empowered here?
Nothing honestly brings me more joy in this world than an empowered neurodiverse person. People joke about it, but it is so true. We are like magnets in terms of, I think if your brain works in that amazing way, that you are magnetized to other people whose brain works in that way. And then it almost becomes quite funny to consider a neurotypical world, you know, like, oh, your brain doesn't work like that. How fascinating. But that's ultimately what it is. It's about empowerment, and it's about being able to say, this is a condition that is part of me. You know, it's not extra to me. It's like when we think about person-centered language, being person-centered isn't about I'm a person with so-and-so. You know, it's why, but for me, on a very, very personal level, I'm always very specific about when I talk about disability. I will always say I am a disabled person. I'm not a person with a disability. It's not attached to me. It's not an appendage of me. I'm a disabled person. Nothing really to do with my condition, but actually because of what society is like. So actually, for me, it's really important that that's person-centered. And that's why when we're looking at empowering disabled people, neurodiverse people, it's all about the person. So actually, in every person, that's going to look really, really different. It's things like, it's trying to move away from being like, okay, so if our house worked normally, if your brain worked normally, you know, the word normal is just, I mean, what is normal? Again, and I'm a teacher, so I have no concept of what normal is because I never have 2 days that are the same. But it's moving away from, if you have someone who's navigating this, it's trying to move away from doing the kind of, in my day, if you were doing this, da, 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 da. And it's actually when your young person comes home and they're starting to say, you know, I only lost one of my folders today. It's like, amazing. That is an absolute win. That's fantastic. With my students, I do it all the time. It's the mindset of walking away from doing something. And it's not about coming away and going, I've managed this so well, I'm getting 100% in everything now. Okay. It's walking away from it going, I did my absolute best and I'm really proud of what I did. And here's the progress that I made. You know, we do it a lot with things like with girls that might be dyslexic and with spelling and things like that. And obviously, really, that the aim is, it's not to become a perfect speller. It's to have the management strategies and the skills to be able to use phonological awareness, you know, to be able to piece together those words. And it's about having the process and the understanding to be able to do that. It's almost like the journey is so much more important than the end goal. And being able to go confidently through the journey, go through the journey feeling like exactly the way you are doing it is the best way that you can do it. It's really what any of us can aim for, isn't it, really? And I think it ultimately just comes down to, you know, the amount of students that I'll kind of have conversations with about just the pure labor of being neurodiverse and the emotional labor of being neurodiverse, because every single day it's there. Every single day, you're probably going to have a conversation about it at school. You know, whether that's just going into a classroom and, you know, in the work, maybe needing to sort of look at adaptations, it's always there. So actually, the best progress we can see in someone is that not only are they acknowledging it's there, they're really thriving. It's the difference between surviving and thriving.
What more could you ask for than someone who is empowered and who understands that they need to thrive as opposed to just survive, right? I have a feeling that our listeners are wishing right now that they had you on speed dial. Unfortunately, we have to bring this conversation to a close. Can you offer us sort of 2 to 3 pieces of advice or hope that you want to leave with parents as a takeaway?
The core thing is just listen. You know, that the power of listening is a starting place, that person will feel heard, that person will feel seen, that person will feel acknowledged. I've done so well in not referencing Wicked at all in this podcast because it's my entire realm at the moment. But I know it's been going around a lot online at the moment about holding space and holding space with things. And even though it's kind of become a bit of a funny thing on the internet, actually hold space with it. Really hold space with these things, you know, so listen, hold space with that person. And also, I just don't think you can ever educate enough on this subject. So read, listen, watch everything and anything you can about neurodiversity, but really try and listen to those neurodiverse voices. Because for a very, very long time, disabled people have been spoken about, research has been done on them. Things have been talked around it. And we're in an amazing space now where actually neurodiverse and disabled voices are the ones talking about themselves and their experience. So as much of that you can possibly consume to be able to really understand that essentially you want your education to be from the people that are having the lived experience from it. The more we learn, the more we know. And the more we learn about people, the more we know. The more we learn about other people, the more we learn about ourselves. So those would be my 2 things if I had to choose.
Thank you for reminding us that we need to hold space so that we can open the dialogue so that these young women in our lives will feel safe to unmask and that ultimately our goal is to empower them to move out in the world and share their brilliance and their own diversity and uniqueness with the world. And the world will be a better place if we can do that. So thanks so very much for your wisdom, Emily.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Connected Girl, a podcast produced by the International Coalition of Girls' Schools to address real issues that impact the lives of girls we know. This episode is the 3rd in a series of 6 podcasts, engaging listeners to think about the many ways that the connections in girls' lives keep them whole and healthy and let them know they matter. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Connected Girl on the ICGS's podcast channel on educating girls so you can check out the rest of the series. Thanks for listening. It's important to the girls in your lives that you do. The International Coalition of Girls' Schools created this series in true partnership with 2 stories, podcast production by Carol Williams with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Rebecca Fancel. For more information, please refer to the show notes.